Okay, we're now actually starting with the text. Last time was the introduction. So I hope you have chapter 23 of Genesis. I don't think we'll be looking at other sections this morning, just that part. So even if you just have the Chumash and not the Tanakh, you'll be okay. Okay. I gave all the preamble last time, so I'm just going to go right into the text. All right? Remember, though, that Abraham has just finished with the binding of Isaac, and Isaac obviously was not sacrificed. And immediately after that, there's a small coda where Abraham hears that his brother has had a whole bunch of kids. Okay? So Abraham has just almost sacrificed his one child, only to discover that his brother seemingly effortlessly has children with his wife, basically, you know, a couple times a year. There were miracles in ancient times, what can I tell you? And they were at work the next day. Chapter 23. Okay. This is the only section of the Torah that is named after a woman. Right? Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah. And the immediate paradox of calling it Chaye Sarah, which means the life of Sarah, but it commences, of course, with what?
Her death.
Her death. So this gives rise to endless sermons about how, you know, you can only, for example, the famous one, which is actually a famous one in ancient Greece, about how you can only evaluate someone's life after they die. Right? Call no man happy until his death, as the ancient Greek legend has it, and there's a surrounding story, but you get the idea. And not only does it say, V'yu chaye sarah mea shana, v'esrim shana, v'sheva shanim, shnei chaye sarah. And I read the Hebrew because the English can't quite capture the repetition and nuance, but it says literally, okay, this was the life of Sarah, 100 years, and 20 years, and 7 years, the years of the life of Sarah. So there are all these, Rashi says, you know, she had the wisdom of a 100-year-old and the beauty of a 20-year-old and the sinlessness of a 7-year-old, which is actually the right reading of Rashi. There are some other readings. One of them reads, their manuscripts get messed up. This is an important lesson. Many manuscripts of Rashi says she had the beauty of a 7-year-old and the sinlessness of a 20-year-old and the wisdom of a 100-year-old. And obviously, it should have been sinlessness of 7 and beauty of 20, right? But as I was saying the other day to a separate group, you know, when all manuscripts are copied by hand and you copy day after day and late into the night, it's easy to make mistakes, to reverse things, to write things twice. And so Rashi, remember, for many hundreds of years wasn't printed. He was just copied. Anyway. Okay, yes, exactly. And by the way, they know the different kinds of scribal errors are all well known to scholars. So it's not that if you copy things out, you'll make the same kind of errors that scribes did over hundreds and hundreds of years. But if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls and you look at the Torah, you will see that it's remarkably accurate. There are some differences, but they're very slight, which I'm going off on another tangent, but just for those of you who have friends who may be what I will call literalists or on the very far right wing of the religious spectrum, you can remind them that the earliest manuscripts of the Bible we have date from the 10th century and that no two manuscripts of the Torah are identical. None of them. Right? Now, the differences are small, right? It's not like in one place it says Abraham, another place it says Isaac. The differences are small, but it shows what's called a transmission history, right? Just like you used to play circle around the lane or whatever you called it when you were a kid, one person would whisper to another, to another, to another, to another until it got to the end. Manuscripts, when they get copied over many, many, many years, get changed. Okay, so 100 years, 20 years, 7 years, these are the years of the life of Sarah because, say the rabbis, all her years were filled with life. The rabbis make the comment, Yeshanim shel chayim v'shanim shel enan shel chayim. There are years that are full of life and years that are not full of life. in everyone's life, right? There are years of darkness and there are years of light. But Sarah lived all of her years, all 127 of them. All right? Now, she dies in Kiryat Arba. Where it got its name is also a question, whether it's from an individual or from four people or city of four. Anyway, but it's called Hebron now, all right, whatever now means. And it's in the land of Canaan, and Abraham proceeded to mourn for Sarah and to bewail her. Now, again, usually this is taken, I have an original interpretation to bring you this morning. Usually this phrase, to mourn for Sarah and to bewail her, is taken as the depth of Abraham's mourning, right? Usually you say you mourn for somebody, but to mourn and bewail is this double activity, right? It's not just that he mourned her, it's that he publicly showed how much he mourned. So here is a passage that actually is quoted in William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, an amazing and wonderful and remarkable book. But it's written by Alphonse Daudet, who was a French writer, okay? And he's talking about the funeral of his brother, okay? He starts off, homo duplex, which means dual man. In other words, I have two people inside of me, okay? Duplex, like a two. Writes Alphonse Daudet, the first time I perceived I was at two was at the death of my brother Henri, when my father cried out so dramatically, he is dead, he is dead. While my first self wept, my second self thought, how truly given was that cry, how fine it would be at the theater. I was then 14 years old. Now, he's mourning, but part of him is the writer. Right? And is thinking, wow, Dad, that was a really good cry. If you could reproduce that on the stage, that would be terrific. This horrible duality, he says, has often given me matter for reflection. Oh, this terrible second me, always seated while the other is on foot, active, living, suffering, bestirring itself. This second me that I've never been able to intoxicate, to make shed tears, or to put to sleep. How it sees into things and how it mocks. Okay, the second part of you that, and it doesn't matter, almost, there are very few experiences where you don't stand separate and watch yourself and say, you know, like right now, I'm doing okay, or right, boy, I can't believe I just said that, and boy, how stupid is that. And even when you're mourning, you're two people. And that duality is what he notices in himself, and I think everybody notices in themselves most of the time, someone standing separate apart from you, evaluating you. And when it says that Abraham, and by the way, the one experience that I know of where there's no separation from yourself, and I'll tell you how I learned this, is pain. You stub your toe and you're not watching you until the instant of acutest pain goes by, then you can watch yourself. But for a second, you're only in the pain, right? If you ever suffer acute pain, for an instant, nothing else exists. It obliterates the rest of the world. You just hurt. And I learned this when I was reading Martin Buber, and he talks about the I-thou experience, which is the total experience of another person. And he says it resembles nothing so much as pain. And I thought, pain? Why pain? He's talking about this being the peak experience of a human being. And then I thought about it and I realized that pain is almost the only experience in which you are completely enveloped, even if only for a second. I'll let you think of others, and if it's true, let's just leave it at that. But the point is, when Abraham says that he is mourning, that when the Torah says that Abraham mourns Sarah and bewails her, I wonder if it isn't pointing a little bit to his private grief and his public display. Right? And the public display is always different from the private grief. Because anybody here who has ever sat Shiva knows it's impossible not to worry about what people think when they come into the Shiva house. Do they have food, right? Are they comfortable? It's the reason that you cover the mirrors in a Shiva home, right? The traditional superstitious reason is demons and so on, but the the traditional deeper reason is you're not supposed to worry about yourself. You're not supposed to look at yourself in the mirror and think how you look. Now, you don't have to cover the mirror unless you're worrying about it, right? If the tradition thought you weren't going to worry about it, they wouldn't tell you to cover the mirrors. But they know that human beings all have this second piece to them. So I do wonder if, especially because Abraham is in a foreign culture, right? He's not a Canaanite. And he's not a Hittite, as we'll discover in just a minute when he has to negotiate for the land. I wonder if he isn't very conscious of how he's appearing in front of them.
So would a narcissist, like in a typical, like a psychological culture,
yes,
would you say a narcissist can't
see? I would say that a narcissist can't, depending on the degree of narcissism, and I'm saying this as, you know, someone who has absolutely no training in it, but what the heck. The degree to which a narcissist can be in an experience is probably determined in part by the level of their narcissism. On the one hand, they're the only thing that exists, so their experiences are everything. On the other hand, they're always acutely conscious of how they appear to other people because they're narcissists. I mean, that's what they do, right? Remember where Narcissus is from, right? Narcissus is the Greek youth who looked into a pool of water and fell in love with himself because he thought he was so beautiful. So the mirror is actually the literal, right? It's the literal modern analog to what happened with Narcissus. Actually, Oscar Wilde has a really great comment on the Narcissus story. He says, "The pool, when it realized how beautifully it could reflect Narcissus, fell in love with itself," right? Which I think is just, so, anyway, okay. So there you have Abraham mourning her and bewailing her. And also, I think there is extra poignancy. Again, remember that the Bible isn't divided up into chapters. Our book is divided up into chapters, but when you read the Torah, there's no division. So you have just finished reading how his brother had all these kids and then his wife dies, okay? So it's made especially painful, which Abraham's life has been, after all. This struggle for fertility has been the whole story of his life. A lot of the story of his life, yeah.
Who named the chapters?
The Masoretes. The Masoretes came along in the 8th, 9th, 10th century and divided up the Torah into words, into sentences, into chapters, and based on old rabbinic interpretations, they didn't make it up from nothing, gave the parashiot their names and so on. Okay, the Masoretes were textual scholars of the Jewish tradition is the best way, I suppose, to define them. Okay, people who, there are people whose great love, it's like, I'm trying to think of an equivalent. You know, it's almost like people who love English grammar. There are people whose great love is to study the grammar and history of textual transmission of the Hebrew. And that's, you know, that's what they care about. And the Masoretes, God bless them, did that for us. They're also the ones who assign the nikudot to many of the words that told you what was in the past tense, what was in the future tense, what applied to which speaker, and so on. Okay. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead and spoke to the Hittite, saying, okay, "I am a resident alien among you. Ger toshav anochi imachem." So let's stop on that phrase, because that's a really interesting phrase, right? A ger is what? A stranger. And a toshav is a resident. So what's a stranger resident? I'll give you really three different possibilities. One is that it's a legal status, right? Somebody who resides, like a resident alien, right? We have almost the same phrase in English, which is somebody who does not belong to the society, someone who's not a citizen, but who has residency permission, okay? That's the easy way of understanding it. The second way of understanding it is that this presages what Abraham is and what he will be. Because where is Abraham right now? He's in the land of Israel, right? But it's not Israel yet. this is the land that God has promised him, which is about to become a big theme of what's about of this chapter. So he's both speaking about where he is now and also what God has promised, and it's a way of reminding himself and maybe even reminding God that, you know, you promised this to me, although I don't have it yet. But the third idea, which is what the Magid of Dubnov says, is for my money the best of the three. I don't, you know, they all have their place, but this one is the deepest. He says every human being who is self-aware knows that what they are in this world is a ger toshav. Right? He says you're a stranger in this world, but you're resident in it. And the time that you sin is when you feel too at home, when you don't realize the sort of alienation from the world that you're supposed to feel because your spirit is not entirely designed for this world. Your spirit is really designed for another world, and you're in this world as a temporary transit way to the world in which your spirit will be fully at home, but in this world it's not. It's the Jewish equivalent of that wonderful phrase by the Protestant theologian, Teilhard de Chardin, where he says, we're not physical beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a physical experience. Right? And that's what it means to be a ger toshav. So maybe Abraham is declaring his spiritual status, not just his legal status, when he says to them, I'm a ger toshav, I'm a resident and an alien. Okay, but it is it's a prelude to negotiations. I'm a resident alien. Sell me a burial site among you that I may remove my dead for burial. So sell me, first of all, is the word natan, which can mean give, sell, or pay, all three. And in the Hebrew, that word natan is used a lot in this negotiation, and it sort of flits back and forth between the three, whether it's give, whether it's sell, whether it's pay. And the ambiguity of the word is used by all the parties to make their point, right? As you'll see in just a minute. But the rabbis give a lot of praise to Abraham for this whole passage because he doesn't complain to God. After all, he left his home, he left his family, he went on this journey, he did all this thing. Why? Because God promised him a land. And now he's almost at the end of his journey. His wife has died, and he has to buy a tiny piece of that land in order to bury her. And it seems, frankly, unfair. God promised him the land. Why should he have to buy it? Right. But he does, and there is, first of all, poignancy in the fact that he has to buy this piece of land, and second, a painful reality that the first piece of land that a Jew owns in Israel is a burial plot. Remarkable, if you think about it, right? That's our first piece, yeah.
Doesn't that tie into also when immigrants come to, I know when our ancestors came from Europe, the first thing they did was buy land for
right.
the cemetery.
Yes, when people come, the first thing that they're supposed to establish is, you know, a school and a cemetery and a tamchui, which is a community plate. A tamchui is like a welfare system, basically. Those are the three things that they're supposed to establish right away, because a place to pray as well, but a place to pray doesn't have to be established quite the same way. You can pray anywhere, right? But burial societies were the first societies that people had for obvious reasons. Among other things, when you travel long distances, people die along the way, and you have to bury them almost immediately. So there are parallels in history. Okay, so the Hittites now replied to Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my Lord, which many people see, Adoni, many people see as an acknowledgement of the fact that Abraham is a rich man, and he may be a resident alien, but as we know from wealthy people who immigrate to other countries and may not be part of that, right, part of the structure of that country, they get a sort of uneasy respect. The best place to see this is in England, right? In England, when you have a Robert Maxwell or a Dodi Fayed, who are very wealthy people, Maxwell wasn't really, but he was. I mean, his entire wealth was based on a pyramid scheme, but nonetheless, he had a lot of money for a while. And they have a lot of money, but they don't really belong to the society, right? Maxwell is a Jew, Fayyad is an Arab. And so they belong, but they don't belong. And you treat them with respect. The Hittites say, my lord, to Abraham. What they say when they go home, you know, about him, who knows? But one of the things that money buys you, and we know that Abraham is rich, is good treatment to your face. Nothing guarantees good treatment behind your back, but good treatment to your face, right? You can be a dictator and you don't guarantee good treatment behind your back, but good treatment to your face it does buy. And that's what, I mean, some of the rabbis like to say, and it's a nice thought, and I hope that it's true, that the Hittites treated Abraham that way because they felt his spiritual power and they realized that he was a man of God. This is giving the Hittites a lot of credit, and I would like to think that the Hittites acknowledged that sort of spiritual power, but they're not around to speak for themselves, so who knows? Okay. Yeah, please.
When does the first belief in life after death among Jews come in?
Okay, the first belief in life after death among Jews. This is I'm going to give a really quick answer to a long question. It is certainly clear that Jews were exposed to the life after death idea in Egypt, because Egypt is filled with, I mean, mummies, right? Pyramids, they're all about life after death. So we know that. Whether Jews believed in life after death early in the Bible, I would say depends whether you take a classical view or a scholarly view. The scholarly view is that the theory of life after death somehow always floated among people, right? Always did. You find Neanderthal graves and they found, you know, pollen in them. I don't know if you're aware of this, which suggests that flowers in burial graves are as old as human beings are. Now, why did they bury? I mean, and even older than human beings, since Neanderthals weren't, I mean, they were some species of human, but not the same as ourselves. Why did they do that? Probably because they thought after death, you know, probably, we don't know. So the idea that people lived on after death probably always existed in some way. Whether and how much the Jews believed it and when they believed it, we don't have any evidence for in the Torah until pretty late in the Torah. But I think it's probably, I mean, you have comments about Sheol, and what Sheol is not clear. By the time you get, for example, to Saul calls Samuel up from Sheol, where he was sleeping, and Samuel says, why did you wake me? So it's a very complicated question, but I think it's probably true that human beings had some idea that death wasn't everything from the earliest human beings, even before there were Jews. But who knows? Who knows for sure? Otherwise, you wonder why there's burial at all. I mean, burial, it seems to me, at the core of it, is you have to treat this carefully, not because it used to be a person, but because in some way it still is. So, yeah.
Do Jews believe in reincarnation?
The answer is yes and no. Okay. The question of Jewish beliefs in afterlife is a complicated one, and I will be happy to set aside either a class or a sermon to talk about it, so that I won't. Which is better? You tell me.
Class.
A class, probably. Okay. So, do you want to do next week's class on that?
Yes.
Okay. Next week's class will be on Jewish beliefs of the afterlife. It fits very well with Abraham burying Sarah. Will you please do me the favor and tell people, so that if they want to hear about that, but they're not interested in regular Torah study, they can come. Okay, yes.
Don't the Hittites recognize that Abraham is the elect of God?
Well, that's what the rabbis say. But I mean, that's, as I say, that's giving the Hittites a lot of credit. But I mean, the elect of God might mean a spiritual thing, and it might just mean you're wealthy. So it depends what they think of as the elect of God. You know, the idea that God favors you because you're wealthy is practically universal in the world. Whether they're acknowledging his spiritual power or his wealth, I think, is an open question. And I would like to believe it's spiritual power, but who knows? Okay. You are elect of God among us. bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None of us will withhold his burial place for you for burying your dead. Now, if you only read this sentence, you would assume that it's all about spiritual power. I'm going to make my case for it's not in just a second, right? How do they open the negotiations? Because this is going to be a negotiation. They say, anything in the store, right, is yours. Take whatever you like. Of course, nothing in the store has a price tag, right? It's just whatever you like. Just like someone told me, speaking of nothing in the store has a price tag, may I share with you an outrage that I just learned? I was at this conference, and they delivered in the morning the Wall Street Journal to your door, which I thought made for a very classy hotel. Usually you get USA Today. So I said to someone, I said, you know, this is really very nice. They deliver the Wall Street Journal. Usually get USA Today. He said, do you know that they charge you for USA Today when it's delivered to your hotel room? I said, no. He said, look very carefully on the bill. He said, USA Today actually asked hotel to charge for USA Today. I said, if that's true, I've been duped for years. So I just want to ask you, next time you go to a hotel, you should check and actually see if it's free or not. Because if it's not, then it's the equivalent of the Hittites saying, you know, anything you want is okay. So I can't vouch for that, but that's what I was told. And I thought, because, you know, it's my responsibility as a consumer advocate to share it with you. Okay. Thereupon, now notice what happens. Thereupon, Abraham bowed low to the people of the land, the Hittites, okay? We're reinforcing, by the way, the people of the land are the Hittites, the people of the heaven are God, are the Jews, and also they're going to be the people of the land one day, right? Now the people of the land are the Hittites, but the Hittites are among many, many people of Canaan who are gone forever from history. Nobody claims to be the descendant of the Hittites as far as I know. And he said to them, if it is your wish, right, that I remove my dead for burial, you must agree to intercede for me with Ephron, son of Zohar. Already this lets you know that Abraham is very smart. He has his eye on a piece of property. He didn't just come to them and say, is there any place I can bury, right? Remember that Abraham is already a successful businessman. He knows what he's going to get if he says, by the way, can I have a piece of property? And if this seems cynical, remember that he's picking a place to bury his wife and where he's going to be buried one day. And you're supposed to care about that. And you're not supposed to leave that up to Hittites, right? So he's very careful. And he's already got a place. And it's only then that he comes to them and says, can I have a piece of land with which to bury my wife? They say, of course, anything. And he says, well, as long as you're saying anything, there's this guy Ephron, the Hittite. I wonder if you would be willing to talk to him for me, because Abraham knows very well he might not cut any ice with Ephron the Hittite. But if his own community comes to him and says, you know, we want you to help us, we want you to give this guy the property, then he has a much better chance. Yeah.
So are you suggesting that when he was eulogizing and bewailing her, this was all a setup leading to this?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was all a setup leading to this. I think, obviously, there's a genuine grief. I mean, look what he went through with Sarah. I mean, if he doesn't feel her absence, it's unimaginable. You know, it would make Abraham into a completely false human being. What I think is that the way the world is set up, human beings are given very few pure unmediated experiences. They can't afford them. Very few. Let me give you an example. You go to enjoy something with your child. There is a part of you that is always watching your child to see how they're reacting and whether they're okay. Always, right? You're never free to just have a good time on the ride, right? You're always looking out of the corner of your eye. The same thing is true if Abraham, as soon as she dies, he knows he's got to bury her somewhere. And that awareness can't leave him, because it's his responsibility. He's got to do it. So I think that I almost want to say if Abraham had the privilege to just bewail her, he probably would. But he doesn't have that liberty because he's not free of the mission of living in the land of Israel. So there's that too. The more public, the more responsible you are, the less you have space for that private grief. I mean, think of a politician, right? Think of Jackie Kennedy when her husband, who was the president, was shot and killed. Her grief, or the Queen, right? Their grief is entirely public. Not entirely, obviously, largely public. And that is actually part of the responsibility that they take on when they take on that position. And that's just the way it is. And you can't, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And Abraham is a public figure and a man of God, so he's got to do this right. Let him sell me the cave of Machpelah that he owns. He doesn't say give, he says sell, right? Although it does say vayitain li, which could be give, but they're assuming, remember, this is all the translator. Yitain could be give or sell, they assume he's sell, which is at the edge of his land. Let him sell it to me at full price, okay? But again, he uses the same, this time he says, we say, so they, malei nenu li, right? Malei nenu li means full, let him give it to me, full price, for a burial site in your midst. Okay, now look at Ephron, who is, by the way, I think no less careful a negotiator than Abraham. And then we'll talk about why all these negotiations are in there, because why does the Torah, which you know, doesn't say anything about the most important issues sometimes, why does the Torah record all the particulars of Abraham's sale of Machpelah? Ephron was present among the Hittites. So Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, all who entered the gate of his town, saying, all right, so Ephron is there. And he answers them, he answers Abraham so that everyone can hear him, which means that Ephron is also playing a dual game. What he wants and whatever, how he appears to his community, because this is his community. He says, no, my Lord, hear me. Hasadeh natati lach, right? Which is the same word, natain. This cave, I give you the field and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people, bury your dead. It's clear that he is saying ostensibly, it's yours, right? Yes.
Like there's this duality to that as well. Like, oh, take it, but no, really pay me a lot.
Well, that's what he's going to say. Yes. That's what it's going to be, because he says, he doesn't just say, I'll give you the cave. I give you the field. I give you the cave. Take it. It's yours. All right? Now, Abraham understands that message very well. And don't forget that Abraham is, and Ephron knows that Abraham is, an alien. So he doesn't want to appear to be someone who would take things without, because there, this is a test here. You know, he's going to stay there. He may want to buy more land. Let's see how he buys land. How does Abraham respond? Abraham bowed low before the people of the land. This is the second time that Abraham has bowed down before them. By the way, the idea that you can't bow down before people is clearly not, that's not a Jewish. There's no reason why you can't bow in front of somebody as long as you're not worshiping them, and as long as it's not misunderstood as worshiping them. And in the Esther story, the reason Mordechai doesn't want to bow down is because of Haman. That's how most people assume it, because Jews for centuries and centuries have bowed down before kings and lords, because you know what would happen if you don't, right? So it's true that it developed over time, that idea. But it's clear in the Bible that bowing down in front of somebody is just the equivalent. It's the equivalent of being very courteous and shaking their hand. It's not considered, you know, it's not considered worship or sacrilege or anything like that. Okay. And spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land. And I think it's so interesting how all of these negotiations, the Torah tells us again and again, are public negotiations, right? All of them are public. Again, he speaks in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, if only you would hear me out. Just listen to me. Let me pay the price of the land. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there. Abraham says, no, please let me pay. Okay? And Ephron replies to Abraham saying, my Lord, and I love, this is my favorite line in the whole chapter. My Lord, do hear me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? Right? Now, here's what I assume. I think that's terrific. Here is what I assume. I assume, and some scholars assume, that they're actually following a fairly well-known formula, and that this is not, you know, There, this is the dance that you do. No, take it. No, 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 really, what's $400? Okay, here's the $400, right? Because it does feel like, and in fact, what this is one of those chapters that Bible scholars really love, because they found now Hittite documents that talk about how negotiations are conducted and so on, and it illuminates the text, and it seems pretty clear that this is a protocol. Right? This is what you do. You don't start off by saying, here's a sweater for $50. Instead, you say, you know, any sweater in the store is yours. And you say, oh, how beautiful this sweater is. And the other person says, take it. And they say, no, I couldn't think of taking it. And the other person says, why wouldn't you take a sweater that's worth $50? And the other person says, ah, here's your $50. Okay? But the song and dance is not over yet, because once Ephron has established the price, there's more. He says, what is it between you and me? Go and bury your dead. And then it says, of course, Abraham accepts Ephron's terms. Right? So, what's that?
He was Iranian.
Yes, exactly. So, I was going to say that in cultures, actually, I really want to say this. One second, I want to give you what I think of as an insight, really, into Iranian society in America. That I kind of came to a long time ago. I just don't say it publicly because someone might take offense. So I'm only going to say it to you. Right, exactly. No, you won't. I know you won't be offended. Actually, because also I'm convinced that this is true. In cultures where people know each other, where they know each other, it's a culture of relationship and bargaining and not of law. You don't apply law to your relatives. You don't do that. I mean, nobody, you know, you don't say to your relative, I'm sorry, according to the law, I have to do this, right? Not traditionally. When you come to a society where it's too large and too diverse, and most of the people that you're dealing with are people you don't know, who are not your relatives, then you start to deal with law and not with relationships. That's why in America you might actually deal with your relatives because of law, because America is a society of law, and it's a society of law because people don't know each other, right? And when you don't know the person you're dealing with, you need a third party to appeal to, and that's the law, okay? When it is a culture of relationship, there are unspoken rules in every family. There are unspoken rules. You don't mention his ex-wife to my brother-in-law. Not my brother. My brother-in-law doesn't have an ex-wife, but I don't even have a brother-in-law. I have three brothers, but... I have a brother-in-law on the other side, but he also doesn't have an ex-wife. So, just thought I'd mention it. So, every family has rules like that, right? And you know the rules, and that's why you can say, take any piece of land, what's the thing worth 400, because everybody knows the rules. When you have an Iranian community that transplants itself to America, they work by the old rules in a new system. So, they'll make a deal, but of course it's always susceptible to more bargaining because what's the letter of the law is ridiculous. What matters is what goes on between people. It's interactional. It's not legal, right? So people who are used to an interactional system, a bargaining system where nothing is ever done until it's actually completely done, walk into a system where something is done as soon as the law says it's done. And there is a continual clash of business systems that are based on the two different kinds of societies that people came from. And I noticed this as soon as I came, when people started to talk about Iranian business practices, and I was familiar with them, but they're just not American business practices, and they don't work in an American system. What they seem is, instead of relational, they seem dishonest. Because the law is the law is the law. And in fact, there are other systems where that's even more the case. I had a conversation with a lawyer actually at this same conference where he was talking about working with, he does international arbitration. And he was talking about working with German lawyers. And he said, this will give you an insight into how the German, he says this, I asked him, has he gotten insights into other mindsets and legal systems? He said, I'm doing an international arbitration with a German lawyer, and it was a fraud worth millions of dollars, and we are the arbitrators, and we're talking about it after the sides have presented their case, and he said, we have to dismiss it. And I said, why? And he said, because they filed the papers with the wrong clerk. And I said, millions of dollars. right? And he said, but they filed the papers with the wrong, like he's puzzled because they didn't do it. And I'm not, like I said to him, are there echoes in your mind of, you know, Germany in the middle of the century? And he said, but we finally worked out a compromise. But his idea was that the whole purpose of the law was, you know, the law is the law is the law. And that's the sort of opposite from what you're getting here in a negotiating society. So anyway, that's my, so when you say he's Iranian, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. When everybody knows everybody, it's insulting to do it according to law. You know, you do it according to the relationship. Yeah.
Isn't it the same as with Arafat? The negotiation agreement,
yes,
with Palestinians is even,
right,
worse, because even when they shake hands,
I think that's exactly
house,
right. Yep.
They go back and their culture is,
I think that,
absolutely.
I think that part of what happened with someone like Arafat was that he both didn't acknowledge and also used, he didn't acknowledge the culture that he was stepping into, which was the culture of international diplomacy, but I think he also used his native culture to exploit, right, the negotiation. But anyway, yeah, it does make it more difficult, but you know, the Israelis live in the Middle East. They need to know what the culture is. And I think they do, but it's just not. And it's a little bit Israeli culture too, by the way. You know, Israeli culture is sort of a mix of Western culture and Middle Eastern culture. As you know, if you've ever been in a business deal with an Israeli, it's not exactly identical to a Western business deal. And with that, let's move on to Ephron the Hittite. I can't believe you would read anything, but hold on. Let me just, right, that I should have turned. Let me just finish this. Okay. I just want to read one more sentence and then I'll take other comments. Abraham accepted Ephron's terms. Abraham paid out to Ephron the money that he'd named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver at the going merchant's rate. Okay. So he was very careful. I noticed that he says, where is it? Hold it. It's at the going merchant's rate obviously means also, by the way, that Ephron didn't cheat him, or at least it seems so, but it was the going rate. He didn't get any bargain either. So you could see it either way. I want to read you what the other point that Sarna makes about this. He says, the going rate means a specification necessary and important in view of the variations of shekel weight, right? You can always give like light shekels, and that's why they weigh money, you know, or bite on money to make sure that it's real. There was a common and royal weight within each class, a light and a heavy standard. The Hebrew technical term has its counterpart in the Akkadian machirat ilaku, the current rate, found in the laws of the kingdom of Eshnunu, deriving from the last quarter of the century, 20th century BCE. In other words, they found something that 500 years predates Abraham that reflects the same sort of comment, which is why scholarship can make such wonderful insights about the Bible and what I was talking about before, about whether people who translate it know cognate languages. We were talking about that before the class. Okay, comments, questions? Yeah, Julie.
Seems like he knows him well, the way he says, what is that between you
and, yeah,
him? And they're perfect,
I know,
strangers.
Yeah, although if you walk again into something like the Shuk, my friend, my good friend, you know, for you, whom I've known all of 17 seconds, for you, I will give you this belt for only, you know, for the other Schmendrick who just walked out, I wouldn't do this, but for you, and you know what? It works. As a business, it's very hard to resist the charm of somebody who tells you you're special. And that's what successful businessmen do, you know, not only in the Shuk, but just in general, right? Somebody who is good at, you know, that, it makes you feel like they're, that's what a good politician does too.
You're special.
You're the only one who exists in their eyes, you know, at that moment, and not all those other people that, you know, they don't care about. Yeah. Yes, well, that's right. There is a Jewish principle, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law. That's a Jewish legal principle, and this is an illustration of it, absolutely.
And then the commentary I have shows in 16 that Ephron's name is changed. The vav is deleted.
Yes.
After the transaction. So he's diminished.
Right, yeah.
That's clear that he's an exclusion.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I forgot to mention that. That's right. You notice that. If those of you can read the Hebrew, look in 16. The first half, the Ephron has a vav in it, and the second half it doesn't. One half it's male and one half not. So they see, right, that since Ephron is not actually truly willing to give him, he's diminished by the transaction. Thank you. And the other, well, I'll leave that aside for the moment. Yeah, go ahead. Don. It's not inappropriate, but you could spin it all ways, you know? I mean, if you want to, you can say that means that it's only legitimate if you've purchased the land. But really, the claim, the Israelite claim to the land, if it's biblical, doesn't come from this story, right? It comes from the promise that precedes it, so. Yeah.
There's a danger, I think, in the world of politically corrupt. I will say something that's in fact I've done. When two Americans shake hands on a deal, it's a deal. When you make a contract with the British, the negotiations begin after you sign the contract.
Okay.
You have to know that going
in. Yeah.
And if you say that to someone, they'll say, how can you make such a comment? Is that it's a deal? You're generalizing a whole group of people with one incident.
Right.
But the fact is, that's been my
point. Well, there are national cultures, but it's tricky to, I think you're allowed to talk in general about national cultures, but not about national characteristics in some way. You know, the fact that that there's a bargaining culture, then all of a sudden starts to turn into characteristics. That means they're dishonest, right? So there is a careful line between national cultures and national characteristics. Like saying, for example, that, you know, I don't know, well, you all know, I mean, look, this has been done a lot in Jewish history. I don't have to give examples. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Is there a reason why Ephron
chose what?
The mystical reasons he chose that?
Well, Machpelah means what?
To fold.
Kafel, right, is to fold or double. So first of all, he's foreseeing, according to the tradition, that not only will he be buried there, but also, right, the other patriarchs will be buried there. And also kaful double means, according to some interpretations, that there is, you know, this world below and world above. So it's also, it's Abraham is buried below, but also remembered above, and is in the land of Israel because he's supposed to guard over it. The one thing that I will say is that the reason this makes the whole Israeli-Palestinian question vexed is that, of course, Machpelah is in Hebron, and Hebron is on the West Bank. Or Judea and Samaria, depending on your political leanings. So that, you know, the truth is that even though Jerusalem is the most fought over emotional territory, Hebron is as integral to Jewish history as any other city in the world, as you can see, yeah. Do we think that the cave of Machpelah is the same place as is here in the text? The only honest answer to that is it is impossible to know. It's impossible to know. Only if you believe that it is possible for several thousand years, you have to believe lots of things. One, that they really were buried in a cave in Hebron, and two, that you could transmit that over thousands of years without losing that site. Maybe, I don't think there's any way that someone could tell at this point. You're never going to excavate the cave, and even if you did, and even if you found someone buried in there. Right, yeah, how would you know? How would you know? So, I don't know. But I will say this about that, which is that I really do think that sacred places are not only places where sacred things happen, but places that acquire sanctity from the people who come there over the generations. So, even if Rachel's tomb is not Rachel's tomb, it's a sacred place, right? So even if you prove tomorrow, which don't get me wrong, but even if you prove tomorrow that the temple was actually built in, you know, Ottawa, and it wasn't built in Jerusalem, the wall would still be a sacred place. Anyway, other comments or questions? Yeah.
Is
chapter for a minute, when he mourns and then bewails, if you take it just from where we came from, and he had just come down from the Akedah,
right,
and he never saw her alive again, right? So don't you think that there's...
At least not that we know of.
Not that we know of.
Right.
And so there's this,
right,
you know, maybe this double pain of... I never got to say I'm sorry that I
right.
did this, or I never got to explain why I did this.
Could well be. It's all shrouded in silence, whether Abraham ever saw Sarah again, whether she died right after the Akedah or not, it doesn't say. I mean, remember that the Bible is largely, not completely sequential, but it doesn't always tell you how much time has elapsed between the sequences. You just don't always know. But if so, it makes it especially poignant. I want to, since we're almost done and there are only a few verses left, and next time we're going to start something else, let me just read the last couple. So Ephron's land in Machpelah near Mamre, the field with its cave and all the trees, anywhere within the confines of that field, passed to Abraham as his possession in the presence of the Hittites, all of whom entered the gates of the town. And Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the field of Machpelah facing Mamre, now Hebron, and the land of Canaan. Thus, with the field, its cave passed from the Hittites to Abraham as a burial site. Now, I just want to say to you, again, this is one of those verses, there are a couple of verses like this, that give modern biblical critics such satisfaction and glee and interest, and gave traditional critics a little bit of, which is, when it says, now Hebron, right, when did it become Hebron? If it became Hebron when Abraham was still in it, that's not a problem, because this, remember, this is the Torah given at Sinai. But if it became Hebron after the Israelites entered the land of Israel, how are they saying now Hebron when the Torah was given at Sinai before they entered the land of Israel, unless the Torah was actually written later? Right? So that's those sorts of things I just want to call your attention to, because it's not that there aren't traditional explanations, there are, but there are things in the text that make it a little bit, that are, for modern scholars, are explained by the fact that the Torah is written later when it's already called Hebron, right? After the Israelites live there and after it's a different city and so on. And now they're saying, by the way, guys, now this place, I'm talking about this place that's now, we all know is Hebron, but back then it was called. But if it's at Sinai, then you have to explain it a different way. Yes?
It makes any difference. My version says the same is Hebron. So
it's the same problem. It's the same problem. Why is it called Hebron when it isn't Hebron yet?
I'm thinking maybe it has two names at the same time, and one was maybe.
That is one of the explanations, because it says Vehi Hebron, and she is Hebron, or it is Hebron. That's why the verse in 12:7, which has the same problem but more acutely, Hakna'ani Azba'aretz, the Canaanite was then in the land. Which is the exact same problem. Why are you saying was then in the land if they're still in the land when the Torah is given at Sinai? But you can grammatically finesse your way out of these, and I don't want to suggest that that's the wrong explanation. A lot depends, like everything else. Everything shifts with a twist of the kaleidoscope, right? If you see this clearly given at Sinai, then it's just a small grammatical peculiarity that you want to explain as God is just giving you all the names of the city so that later generations will understand what the city is called. If you think the Torah was clearly written later, then you say, well, obviously that's why it was written later. But it's at least worth noting that that's there. So, okay, any final questions? Yes?
I have a question. If he was a stranger and he had to buy a burial site, where was he living? And how come you don't talk about,
Notice before that, if you go back, Abraham is on chapter 21, verse 34. See where Abraham is living? 21:34. As far as we know, until this moment, he's living in Beersheba in the land of the Philistines. Right? He's residing in the land of the Philistines. Now he's moving over to the area of the Hittites. They lived in a different part of the land of Canaan. So he was alien among the Philistines. Now he's alien among the Hittites.
But but how come we don't talk
but
about
it's not his part,
where he had to live and he didn't have to buy where he was living?
He, I apparently didn't, I don't know whether he bought it or he just grazed that land. Remember, when he separates from Lot, Lot takes part of the land, he takes the other part, but I'm not sure why it is that that land doesn't belong to someone. It may be partly the difference between pasture land and city land. You know, that the Hittites actually, someone owns the land that he wants, whereas the other land was, it was a nomadic society, so people were going back and forth, didn't necessarily belong to anyone.
Well, I think the difference is that where you're buried is a permanent.
That's also true, right. Where you're buried, you have to have forever. Someone else can't come along and take it tomorrow. Last comment, yeah. Ah, yes, we did not talk about that, but we are going to next time. We'll open with that next time, and it will lead us into Olam Haba, the world to come. So we'll talk next time about the negotiations, why they're in such detail, and the world to come. Thank you.